This is GamesAtWork.biz with Phaedra Boinodiris, Michael Martin, and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone, and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 109, Phone Floppers.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Michael Rowe here on a beautiful, cold, but warming dramatically over the next few days day in North Carolina with my co-host, Michael Martin.
Hello, Michael, and I'm in a drama-filled day that is cold, too.
Drama-filled, that doesn't sound good.
Nah, well, maybe it's dramatic. I don't know. It won't be dramatically. It'll be dramatically warmer. Yes. So I'm really happy we're back together again, and fingers crossed, things will work in a happy way for us on the recording.
That the recording will be suitable and decent enough for people to hear it. Unlike last week's, which unfortunately, not so much. It's a great week, and we've got a couple of interesting links to talk about. I think the first one is from our co-host Phaedra, Michael, that you pinged over on this new way of paying off your student loan.
Yeah, this is kind of fun. Phaedra posted this, and I saw it, and I was like, oh, this could be kind of interesting. And then we took a look at it. So it's a Wired article about an online game to help you pay off your student loans. And I thought when I started reading through this could be really, really interesting. You know, it's kind of like a you don't know Jack sort of, you know, game where you can start spending a little bit of money and you can play trivia. Which, you know, arguably, if you're a good student, you might have some good insight as to the trivia, and you might know it pretty well. But the way that it works is the true or false kind of game. You spend 50 cents to try to play a game, very one you do. Three wrong answers, and you're out. And if you're good enough to keep going, it gives you an opportunity to win some money. And according to the article, the way that this goes is some of the money from that 50 cents will go to the game organizers and providers to fund the ongoing support there. The funds that are collected by this game, once they hit $10 million, the object or the intended objective is to give $5 million to the top people to help them pay off their student loans. So it's going to take a while to build up that kitty, but there's a big incentive at the end of the tunnel. And if you're good enough to be at the top of the queue, as they call it, you stand a chance to get your internet loans or your student loans or your whatever loans forgiven. So yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Actually, I was scrolling through the comments on the article because, you know, my first reaction was, ooh, bad idea. and you know, once you get to that clip level, that target level, then what and how do they pay out, et cetera. And there's one of the investors in the program who made some clarifying remarks to the article. Primarily, the way each funding period works, and it's not a one-time hit $10 million and $5 million goes to the winning team and blah, 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 blah. There evidently is a funding period for each of the dividends, that, as they call it, that they then pay out. And the amount raised, here's a direct quote from one of the investors. The amount raised in each funding period is a dividend is divided as follows. 45% to pay student debt, 45% to the winning team, and 10% to overhead, primarily PayPal. So that's interesting. So if you figure out what the PayPal fee might be and then the cost of running the game and the development cost for developing the game, et cetera, and then look at the remaining 90% split between a team of students who are playing together, who then get just a payout, and then 45% in general to the top players as a way of paying out. That's actually much better than what my first read of the article was perceiving on this. So I guess the question becomes, from a general perspective, if you've gone through 4 years or 6 years or 8 years or 12 years, depending on the degree program that you're going through, of accumulating student debt, is a game/lottery the right message for paying off your debt?
Yeah, well, you know, I think this is an example where reading the comments actually does provide some additional clarity. So that was, you know, first and foremost a good thing. You don't always get more clarity from reading the comments of any article online. And the second piece is well, it is gambling in a way, right? But it's gambling based upon what you know. And arguably, it should be questions that you can't look up very quickly using your other internet devices to try to answer these true-false questions very quickly. So it's interesting. I don't know that I would do it. I do like trivia games. I do like head-to-head kind of trivia games. I did cite You Don't Know Jack, and that's making a resurgence in the iOS store as well.
Yep.
So those can be fun, and maybe there's a way to do a little monetization against this as well. But bear in mind, you are paying to play, and if you're paying $1.50, you know, and getting three answers wrong, you know, there's certainly an enjoyment factor out of it, but you might not be so happy at after spending $1.50 and going up wrong, wrong, and wrong, huh?
Right, exactly. And I guess the other thing that's interesting to me is when you think about paying off student debt through games, would it be much more effective to have a open free game supported with ads to provide almost a charitable contribution for paying off debt versus, as you pointed out, more of a gambling approach to paying off student debt, which, I mean, if you're going to do that, then you might as well go all out on trivia and try to become a contestant on Jeopardy, you know, and be the next Ken Jennings.
Well, that's the equivalent, right? You know, if you go on Jeopardy and you win enough that pays off your student debts, why not? So maybe you take the charitable angle a little bit differently. And what if you were playing a charitable version of this game and the proceeds are being targeted at disadvantaged populations that would benefit by having their student loans paid off, or by creating a pool of money to grant student loans to a particular population? That could be kind of interesting too.
Yeah, that's true. And I guess it's one of the same reasons why I'm not a big fan of lotteries in states, because the people who play them are the ones who should most get the benefit based off of it going to education, but who are least in the position to be able to play it financially, right? So, you know, they play to win big, but the whole purpose of it really shouldn't be to win big, but the contribution to improving education in the state. So I have really mixed feelings about games like this across the board. And so if it was purely entertainment supported by ads and the revenue on the ads was used as a way of improving education or paying off debt, very different story in my perception on how this process or how this game would play.
So, you know, maybe this is the right segue moment to an article that you found about the Internet Archive and what they're doing to help preserve games so that people can play them for free.
Yes. So earlier this week, I saw a TechCrunch article come in my feeds, and I'm a big reader of TechCrunch. And I actually had found this archive a while back, the specific archive on archive.org, which is going through and taking old console and DOS games and putting them up in the I'm trying to remember the name of the emulator, MES emulator, MESS. And also there was a main emulator at one time that I used to play on some of my older PCs in the day, to take these old games that are discontinued, that are no longer available, take the cartridges, take the old code, and put them up in an emulator on the Internet Archive to allow you to kind of go back in memory and history and play games. And one of the games I was playing earlier today was one of my favorite games when it first came out, and I remember seeing this on the Commodore 64. It was called Archon, not to be confused with our friend of the show's game, Akron. But what Archon does is it's a chess-like game where each piece has special capabilities and abilities, and you play it like chess, but when the chess pieces come to battle, it becomes a two-player battle game where, you know, the pawn could, in theory, defeat the queen if you're better playing with the way you battle, right? Because you get behind the queen and hit her with the sword instead of she's using magic to zap the pawn, and one hit from the queen would kill the pawn. But if you're a really talented pawn, you know, you can get 20 hits in and kill the queen, as an example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're pretty good about it.
Yeah, it was really fun back in the day. And they don't have the original game on there, unfortunately, the Commodore 64 version. They have the updated, redesigned version from the DOS game days, which I think was like 92 or 94, called Archon Ultima or Archon Ultimate or something like that. It's really fun. It's really fun.
Yeah, I'm just taking a look at the games they preserved here, and there's some really neat ones, right? You know, there's some of the Sim stuff by Maxis. I'm looking at Sim Ant, you know, is out there. Load Runner's in there, you know, various
Load Runner,
versions.
That was fun.
Remember Load Runner?
Yes, I do too.
So, you know, Donkey Kong, etc. Good stuff. You know, how fun is this? But the article really is focusing in on how difficult it is to preserve existing games, because now with digital delivery, the game and game logic, the software, etc., may not be easily available anymore, especially with all the mobile games too. So just preserving these capabilities in a place where they could be played later have gotten much more difficult because there's no physical media anymore.
Well, actually, it's even more complex than that, because, you know, from my perspective, the fact that there's no physical media is not necessarily a bad thing. Oh, and they do have Archon, the original. Oh, okay. I'm going to have to check out for the next 2 hours and play. No. It's, you know, digital content becomes easily recreatable. The challenge is most of our games nowadays are not standalone things anymore. So not only do you need the media for the game itself, but you need the server components, even if it's something simple as game matching. Right? So, you know, turning, and I'll pick a ludicrous example, World of Warcraft initial version, right, when the level cap was 60, into something on Internet Archive would be really great, because over time they've changed the storyline, they've, you know, changed the way the game plays, and, you know, added new players and lost players. So being able to truly provide the original experience digitally online would be great, but it's not just one thing anymore. It's a, I'll use the term, system of systems, or a game of systems, or a system of games together that make up the experience that the user has. And so it may include things like digital rights management, even for standalone games, like, what was it? The latest SimCity had challenges there where you had to be online connected to their servers, even if you were playing a local game.
Yeah.
So all those types of complexities make it harder and harder for a site like the Internet Archive or any type of archival environment to exist for digital content.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, because now you need all the infrastructure to be somehow hosted, supported, structured for that to work. So I gotcha, and you're right. That now becomes so much more difficult. But, you know, that's the nature, right? That's the nature of the beast. And one might imagine that over time there will be solutions found for that, so that there will be an emulator for the back-end server to allow people to play games that are all multiplayer games,
well, the gaming you and I had dealt with back in the original day, right? The Star Wars Galaxies, the original version, had certain characteristics that, as it changed, caused allow the people to slowly fade away from the game, and the game's now effectively gone. And there were individuals that were reverse engineering the server so that they could stand up their own servers to have their own, you know, team-based worlds for the whole Star Wars Galaxies game platform.
Right, and there are versions too, right? Because these games evolve over time, so it might be that version 1.7 was awesome, and version 2.3 is not so good.
Exactly. And so here's my thought. I think it's more than just even the server and the connectivity around there. It does have to do with the digital rights management that's being built into a lot of these platforms, because I could still capture a server image in a virtual machine and put it up on the cloud somewhere, right? And if with each new release I captured the server image in a virtual machine for each instance of a release, in theory I could roll back to any prior version of the game in sync with rolling back the client side of the game. And then I can just imagine the game matching mechanics to say, okay, Michael Martin is running version 1.7.3 of the client and 1.7.4 of the server, and Michael Rowe is running 2.3.4 of the client and 1.8 of the server. You guys can't play together, but if I would drop down from down to 1.9, we could.
Yeah, and then have that automatically happen.
Yeah, yeah. And suddenly all my level 90 guys get dropped down to level 60. What?
So, I mean, this is exactly the kind of problem that businesses face, too, when you think
exactly.
about it. It's all version control and interface management and back-end support and enterprise service bus communication techniques. It's kind of funny, you know. It's what goes around in the gaming world comes around in the business world.
Yep, it's kind of the whole DevOps story of how do you keep things in sync and keep rolling out capabilities and have the ability to do A/B testing between it. So we could run two different versions of the server and both of us be running the same version of client and find the mismatch, etc.
So
it's just crazy talk.
It is. And speaking of crazy, maybe crazy cuckoo land crazy, I see that you also dropped a link in about the Lego Movie game now being on the Mac App Store.
Yeah, I remember you saying you picked it up for your iPad, if I remember
iOS.
Correctly. iOS. Yep. And it was reasonably priced. The other day I was just kind of checking around on the App Store, and they had a special. And I think it was only for a couple of days for the full Mac version for $9.99.
Yeah, maybe so, but it's available now for $32.99.
Oh, yeah.
And you know what? That's a bit on the steep side, you know, even if it's giving you every character and every extension and everything.
No pay to play here.
No, but I really liked playing this game on iOS, and I played it all the way through, and I was very, very happy to experience and re-experience the movie and how it was imagined by the Lego digital development team. That's a bit steep. I wouldn't be putting that on my Mac.
I've just started, and I've built the Wrecking Ball. I've finished up the entry area. I've now gone down into finding the artifact.
Yes. Okay.
So I'm still
early on. The piece de resistance.
Yes. Yes. That's it. So it's kind of cool to finally move into the next space. And it's going to be fun.
Cool. So is this on the Mac then, right? You did
yes.
buy it when it was okay. So yeah. you jumped on the good pricing.
Yeah, I just happened to be looking. And
well, that was kind of cool.
Yeah, there was that, and even the third edition of BioShock was there. I didn't get that. I've still not finished playing version 1 or version 2. So
Yes, and you still have ways to go because those are involved games.
Very, very involved games. And not being that much of a first-person shooter person, not only is it involved, but to me, I burn out. Now, if I had God mode, on the other hand, that would be good.
Well, I'm sure you could find that if you looked long and hard enough on the various sites. You know?
Yeah, Doom 2 used to have a great version that you could enable not only God mode and all the weapons, but you could also enable walkthrough walls so that you could find the things that you had to find in order to unlock things in order to actually finish the level.
Yeah, when you had to go and search for the secret doors that were always terribly hard to find and you couldn't always... Yeah, I know.
Yeah, yeah.
So before we run out of time, there was one other thing I really wanted to get your take on. This morning, I tweeted something out that was related to me looking at some of the Apple Watch websites. While I was taking a look at the watch and some of the things that it could do, I came across a use case that I absolutely love. I love, love, love this. You know, there have been so many times that I've been on a bus or a train, and I'm not sure if I'm getting off at the right station or not. And the use case for the watch and this one particular app that now I'm forgetting which the name of the app is, CityMap or something like that, was that it would use the haptic engine in the watch to tap you and let you know that your stop is approaching, that you should get off. So if you're on a bus and it's dark and, you know, they skip stops, they don't stop at every stop, or, you know, you're, say, on the train in Japan and you want to get off at Shinjuku station, but you're not exactly sure which station you're at and how many stops there are between the two of them because you weren't paying attention, this is a fantastic use case.
Yes.
So it's starting to – go ahead.
I was thinking about the use case that you gave on the show that no longer exists, of you know, your phone ringing to get you out of a meeting.
Yes, did you use it yet?
No, I did not use that. However, I could imagine taking that and extending its interface to the Apple Watch so that all those beeps and blurps that were causing you problems when you were using it could now just be a haptic response and a tap on your wrist.
Well, right. I was thinking that as well, that it's a very unobtrusive sort of, I need to pay attention to something because it is now breaking through my rules of what is important to bother me at certain times. So you might be like, hey, during the working day, don't bug me except for these conditions.
Yes.
And that might be tapping you on the wrist, and then that would signal you to go look at your phone. So you don't have to look at every beep and boop that was going on during the day.
Yeah, I think that is going to be the interesting set of use cases that'll come out of at least Apple's entry into the watch market. What did you think of the new Pebble launch that just came out?
Well, I liked it. I think it's a nice design, but it's not necessarily something I was going to fall over myself to say, oh, I gotta have one. I think you know this, that I'm a backer of the, and I can't pronounce it right, the Ritot watch, R-I-T-O-T.
Yeah, me too.
And they still haven't shipped that to me. Well, they're still working on stuff, and it's going to take a while, you know, so that's cool. But that has that special projection capability. The Pebble has some integration, but it doesn't have the additional things such as the, you know, pulse measurement and the other kinds of integration, deeper integration in with the iOS devices. And we're going to see a lot more about that on Monday.
Yep.
So I think Pebble is a very innovative company, and I like what they've done. But I only have two wrists, and I'm probably only going to wear one watch at a time. So,
well, I think the interesting thing that Pebble does is they are trying to stay integrated with multiple mobile phone platforms.
Operating systems.
Yeah. And so if you go for the Android Wear capabilities, then you're stuck with Android. If you go with the Apple Watch, you're stuck with iOS. And Pebble is trying to be that bridge between the two. And, you know, let's say a third phone operating system really takes off, maybe Windows Phone with their next version of their operating system becomes phenomenal. And so now I have three platforms. And so I could see Pebble extending to that third platform much more aggressively or positively than I would see either Android Wear or Apple Watch doing. So it'll be interesting to see if that is something that's relevant for most users. Or once you get the phone, are you okay locking yourself into the watch ecosystem that's supported by your phone?
Yeah, I here's my take on it, right? You know, aside from certain sets of populations like tech journalists and the like, most people aren't going to be flipping, switching, flopping from phone to phone. There aren't that many phone floppers, right? You know, it's going to be you're in one or another. And for the amount of time that you're going to carry that device, so even if you are someone who might switch from one to the next, you're going to be carrying it for 2 to 3 years because that's the life of the device. A watch should not be a 2 to 3 year lifespan, right? Many of the watches that I've had over the course of my life have lasted 10 to 15 to 20 years.
Easy.
So, you know, so it'll be an interesting thing to see what happens here and how the watch environment emerges and evolves, because some of them, you know, like some of the Gear watches are very much computers on the wrist, and their capabilities could be extended with software over time, like the Apple Watch could be and like Pebble as well. But there will be some limitations, and eventually there'll be additional sensors or other integration touch points that are not just software driven. They require hardware changes, which means new watch.
Exactly.
So I don't think there's going to be a lot of people that are going to be like, well, I might get another phone in a year and a half, so I want one that's now compatible with multiple phones. I think most people know what phone they have and where they're going to be, and they're not inclined to switch.
Fair point. And it was funny. I was talking with a friend of mine earlier this week about the upcoming Apple Watch announce on Monday, and he was thinking it'd be a great gift for his wife as an anniversary gift to get like the mid-tier one or the gold one. And I was like, well, the gold one just seems crazy expensive, especially for something that you're gonna upgrade in a couple of years.
But we don't know. But we don't know.
And
we don't know how crazy it's going to be. It could be super crazy, but it might not be.
Well, his thought was, you know, if you buy a high-end Rolex right now, right, or other high-end watch jewelry, there's certain maintenance that you have to do every couple of years. That's pretty expensive. And, you know, it is an investment, and he would expect that Apple would make it hardware upgradable. And my gut reaction was, no, they won't.
No, they may make it swappable, right?
Yeah.
They might say, hey, after this amount of time, come back, swap yours out. You will get this amount of discount on your next one, and off you go, right? That could be. There could be a hardware upgradable capability of the watch where you might bring it in a couple of years' time. You pop the back, or the Genius Bar pops the back for you, installs new modules, new components, and you have the same case, same band, same everything, and you're off to the races with a new capability that wasn't there before.
Still don't see it. I still don't see it. I mean, just think about it. Every other time a new iPhone comes out, Apple changes the design so that you know it's the new one. Even if they could gut the insides and plug in a new motherboard and screen, right? I just gut-wise don't see it being swappable that way, unless, and here's the thing, the band, right, the significant portion of the value or the cost, my prediction, of the, I can't remember what they call it, but the premier one, the gold one, that's real gold.
Edition.
The edition. Edition. The edition edition is the band, right? I mean, a solid gold band is thousands upon thousands of dollars. And so maybe the edition is broken into two chargeable components. The watch part, which would be a premium based off of the gold on the watch itself, let's say that's $2,000 to $3,000, and the band, which is another $7,000. And I'm making up numbers, obviously. So spending $2,000 or $3,000, if you're into high-end expensive watches and buying one every couple of years, may be considered reasonable. Maybe that's how they go.
Hard to say. I think we're going to learn
find out
more on Monday.
We'll find out Monday. And by the time that you're listening to the show, our listeners, you probably already know, and you're going, what were those guys thinking?
Yeah, at least the other guy.
Yes.
Don't wear watches like my partner.
Or don't wear watches like my partner. Thank you.
All right. Well, with that, Michael, I know we've hit our time limit for today. So I hope that everyone will come out, join the conversation, post your questions, interact with us on the Twitter or Facebook or all the myriad of places that you find us. And we are eager to know what you think of our little set of predictions here, and see how wrong or right maybe we are.
Maybe. Sounds maybe. Good. And we'll have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you later.
See ya.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz, or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.